recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we're seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We're seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it'll be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you've not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which are starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is February 6, 2011, and Bill Fink and Kaiser are joining us for the fourth installment of the Operation Barbarossa series. How are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh.
Yeah,
shall we give a brief recap of where we left off? I believe it's suffice to say that we've more than demonstrated that the Soviet military was stationed almost exclusively along their western border with Germany, and of course Slovakia and Romania, Germany's allies, and they were preparing for a massive juggernaut into Central Europe and ultimately, of course, Western Europe. They'd already attacked Finland in an act of naked aggression, and that hadn't satisfied their appetite for conquest. They wanted more.
And today we're going to continue with that topic, because this this chapter from Suvorov that I would like to read today and present is entitled Germany's Strategic Resources and Stalin's Plans. And it's going to show that the bulk of the Soviet naval effort was in the Baltic, which is really seems silly unless your primary goal is to make your war on Germany and Scandinavia.
It does seem odd, considering, too, that they had issues going on with Japan. You would think that they wanted the bulk of their naval forces in the Pacific.
Well, right. And what this chapter will demonstrate is not only that the Soviets had planned on a war on Europe all along, but also on how tenuous the German position is without lifelines of iron ore and other supplies from Scandinavia.
Well, Bill, let me add to that. I don't want to disagree with you about Soviet naval strength and its concentration in the Baltic, but St. Petersburg was their main port, and since that was their main contact with Europe, they would definitely concentrate their naval forces there.
Well, right, but they had the White Sea, they had Pacific outlets, and most of their naval forces happened to be in the Baltic.
Oh, well, I'm not going to disagree with you about why they had them there. It's just that to me it would seem more natural for them to keep them there because that's where the European powers were.
I understand what you're saying, but we'll see what Suvorov has to say about it, because I found it quite interesting. I'd like to begin reading this chapter. It's Germany's Strategic Resources and Stalin's Plans. And maybe when we get to talking about the German reliance on iron ore, I know you have a few things to say about Britain and Norway, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Germany wasn't only – that this iron ore – reliance that Germany had on Sweden wasn't threatened solely from the Soviets, right? This is page 146 of The Chief Culprit, Viktor Suvorov. War is gluttonous. That is why every strategist constructs maps of supply routes that enable key raw materials to reach his country and the country of his opponent. His goal is to defend his supply lines and cut off those of the opponent. If one draws a map of supply sources and supply routes, it becomes clear that Germany's position in 1939 was particularly difficult. After 1939, the position did not improve. It actually worsened. On the grand scale, Germany has no raw materials. Germany is tied by thousands of fragile strings to the rest of the world. Taking over Czechoslovakia, Poland, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, France, Yugoslavia, and Greece, and conducting the Anschluss of Austria and Germany did not solve Germany's supply problem. Gaining control over millions of people in huge territories that did not contain raw materials only led Germany to spread herself thin and did not bring any advantages. Here is another aspect of the problem. Germany, France, Belgium all have powerful steel casting industries, but they do not have much iron ore. Too many things on the front and in the rear, from the soles of soldiers' boots to battleships, are made of steel. Due to steel shortages, German leaders, as high-ranking as Goring, seriously considered the possibility of building locomotives out of concrete instead of steel. That would be a neat trick, I think, right? Due to steel shortages, damaged bridges were repaired using wooden logs instead of steel beams. Due to steel shortages, railroad rails from spare tracks were used to repair the damaged sectors of primary tracks. Railroad tracks with two-way traffic were transformed into one-track roads. This slowed the entire rhythm of production in Germany and in the countries Germany occupied. In any case, Hitler could not have counted on a quick victory. He had too many enemies. A long war was a path to suicide for Hitler, in the most literal sense of the word. In order to maintain for just a few years what he wanted to establish, he needed to gain iron ore supply. The richest ore mines in Europe, with high iron readings of up to 60 to 65%, were located in the area of Kiruna Elisir in the very north of Sweden and arrived in German ports through the Baltic Sea. One of the weakest links of the German economy was the loading of iron ore in the Swedish port of Luleå, followed by the long trip along Finland's coast through the Gulf of Bothnia, past the Åland Islands, past the islands Gotland, Åland, Bornholm, and then the unloading in the German ports. The iron ore was loaded almost at the Arctic Circle and was transported across the entire Baltic Sea from the northernmost to the southernmost ports. Neither the British nor the French nor any other fleets posed any threat to the transport of iron ore across the Baltic. For a foreign fleet, breaking into the Baltic Sea was like breaking into a mousetrap and staying there. But the Soviet Navy did not need to break into anything. It was already there in its bases, peacefully awaiting the right opportunity. For defending the Soviet Union, a fleet in the Baltic Sea is not needed at all. Prior to 1940, the Soviet Union held a very small piece of seashore there. For more than 200 years, St. Petersburg, known as Leningrad in the Soviet era, was the capital of the empire. For that reason, along this stretch of shoreline, all the Russian czars, beginning with Peter the Great, had erected fortifications. The entire shoreline was transformed into a chain of sea fortresses, fortified regions, and coastal artillery batteries. That he draws an impressive picture here of the Soviet defenses of St. Petersburg. A coastal battery is something more impressive than a field artillery battery. A coastal battery can be compared to the artillery turret of battleships and cruisers. Under these turrets, there are labyrinths of concrete casemates. A battleship turret weighs several hundred tons, sometimes even several thousand. Unlike the one on the ship, the same gun turret mounted on land can be defended by armored plates of any weight. Under the turret, it is possible to erect casemates from fortified concrete with walls of any thickness. And it must be said that the Russian czars put down enough concrete and steel in St. Petersburg's surroundings, and the Bolsheviks added even more. The coastline defenses of the Soviet Union's Baltic Fleet on June 21, 1941, had 124 coastal batteries. Now, on the front page of my Mein Kampf site, I put a map of the Baltic for this program, and you could see that 124 coastal batteries are actually arranged in a very small portion of coast.
So basically, if you want to get into St. Petersburg by sea, you're going to get shot to hell.
Well, absolutely. There's no way in if you understand what's being said here. The coastline defenses of the Soviet Union's Baltic Fleet on June 21st, 1941, had 124 coastal batteries armed with 253 weapons from 100 to 406 millimeters in caliber, and 60 weapons that were 45 and 76 millimeters in caliber. The statistics of the coastline defensive weapons are impressive. For example, a 305 millimeter cannon could launch shells weighing 470 kilograms. That's 1,000 pounds, right?
To a distance 305 millimeter in caliber?
Excuse me?
What caliber did you say? 305
millimeter? 305 millimeter caliber cannon could launch shells weighing 470 kilograms. That's almost 1,000 pounds.
That's a 12-inch gun.
To a distance of 43.9 kilometers. Okay, so that's a that's 30 miles, right? About 28 miles, 25 miles in there. One of the turrets had the capacity to fire 6 rounds a minute, almost 3 tons of metal every minute. A 406-millimeter weapon launched a shell weighing 1,108 kilograms, that's a ton, to a distance of 45.5 kilometers. This weapon was capable of firing the next round only 24 seconds after the preceding one. That's still 2 a minute. Aside from coastline batteries and forts, the Leningrad region had rather impressive concentration of naval cannons on railroad platforms. These long-range weapons were parked in concrete hideaways. There is a web of railroads around Leningrad, so the long-range weapons on railroad platforms could be maneuvered quickly and fired from prearranged and well-concealed firing positions and then quickly moved away. The most important weapon of railroad artillery was the 180-millimeter cannon with shells of 97.5 kilograms. It could fire 5 rounds a minute, and its range was 37.8 kilometers. There were also even more powerful cannons, the 203, 254, and 356-millimeter cannons. The 356-millimeter cannons on railroad transports shot shells weighing 747.8 kilograms and had a firing range of 44.6 kilometers. Three naval fortified regions protected the direct gateways to Leningrad, the Kronstadt, Izhorsk, and Luzhsk, so the routes to the city could be shelled by powerful crossfire from all directions. Each battery, each fort, each fortified region, and each naval base had ammunition and supplies enough to last them for the entire 4 years of the war. No one would have the idea of launching an amphibious assault here or storming the city. Besides, Leningrad had 91 anti-aircraft batteries with a total of 352 anti-aircraft cannons. Why on earth would the Baltic region need a fleet on top of all this? So John, the Suvorov's contention is that with all of these defensive weapons, the only reason why the Soviets would have a fleet at all in the Baltic was for offensive purposes.
Project their power beyond their own shoreline.
Right. Very good point. Very good point. I mean,
if this,
yeah, it's necessary to have some sort of naval presence just to protect shipping beyond that area, but not if you go on, I'm sure you'll mention the naval power they did.
Oh, yeah. He goes into detail here. If the Soviet Union meant to defend itself, it did not need battleships in the Baltic Sea. In case of need, even without battleships, it was possible to quickly unload barges full of mines at the mouth of the Gulf of Finland and thus to cut off the approach to Leningrad. In defensive warfare, a Soviet Baltic fleet was unnecessary. In fact, this is what happened. The Soviet Baltic fleet stayed without action for the entire duration of the war. In the event of attack by an aggressor, the Soviet Baltic fleet was extremely vulnerable. The aggressor could simply block the Soviet fleet by laying a couple of hundred mines on shallow accesses to the naval bases. Indeed, that was done by the German fleet in June 1941. So the Germans evidently beat them to it. In a defensive war, ships, especially large ones, are forced to sideswipe in a shallow and narrow gulf trapped in a blind alley. In 1939, Hitler launched World War II against the rest of the world, having in his possession only 57 submarines. Now, of course, Suvorov's jumping to conclusions, right? Because Hitler really only in 1939 invaded Poland, and that's the same thing that the Soviets happened to have done. It was the cause of World War II, surely. It guaranteed Germany's fate. However, I don't think that Hitler purposely went to war against the rest of the world in 1939, right?
He didn't wake up and say, I'm going to start a global war and destroy Germany.
Well, right. So Suvorov is slightly mischaracterizing Hitler. And in reality, that's what happened, but I don't think it was Hitler's intention. His opponents were the almighty British and French fleets and potentially the U.S. Navy. Hitler's Navy had led to an uneven battle in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. Had to lead an uneven battle in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, In the Baltic, Hitler had almost nothing left. In the summer of 1941 in the Baltic Sea, the German Navy had only 5 training submarines and 28 torpedo motorboats, some of which were also used for training. The rest were secondary forces, mine blockers, various motorboats, and mine sweepers. But peace-loving Comrade Stalin watched the struggle between Germany, France, and Britain and beefed up the might of the Baltic Fleet. And Suvorov asks, what for? In 1933, Stalin had already said, quote, "The Baltic Sea is a sealed bottle and we can't open it." Nevertheless, out of every 3 battleships, Stalin kept 2 in the Baltic, as if in a corked bottle. In 1941, on the Baltic Sea alone, Stalin had 69 submarines. No one in the world had such a number of submarines collected in one place. What task could Stalin set before his battleships and submarines in the closed aquarium of the Baltic Sea? Only one: to sink German transports of iron ore. There was no other work there for them. Aside from submarines and battleships, Stalin had 2 cruisers, 21 destroyers, 48 torpedo motorboats, and other forces. On the Baltic Sea, the German Navy did not even have its own air force. The Soviet Baltic Fleet had 656 warplanes, mostly bombers and torpedo carriers. Once again, we ask, what was all this for? Why such a huge quantity of the same, of torpedo carriers and bombers, if Hitler had no large ships in the Baltic? The answer is always the same. The targets were not his warships, but his transports of iron ore. At any moment, the Soviet fleet could have raised anchor, reached the German and Swedish ports, blocked them with thousands of mines, and sunk the defenseless transports. This would have ended the war for Germany, and this must have been known and understood in Berlin from the start. And we will see from David Irving later on that this certainly was known from by Hitler. Hitler fought against Britain and France, while behind his back, Stalin held up a high glittering axe. In other words, as Hitler waged war against Britain and France, Stalin didn't go after the iron ore deposits. It's evident to me that Stalin really wanted to wear down Britain and France as well as Germany, because he was thinking about all of Europe, right?
Absolutely. He was thinking...
I think we lost Stalin.
Right, I'll just continue to read.
I said that he was thinking more than just a year or two down the road. He was thinking 10 years down the road.
Absolutely, I believe so, because if he cuts off Germany's iron ore and Germany can't wage war against Britain and France, then he still has to face Britain and France,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. It's the same reason why Trotsky and Lenin were fine with handing over most of the Ukraine to the Kaiser, you know, at the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and that ended World War I for Russia, because they said, we'll get it all back because we're going to spread the revolution to their lands.
And that's what they did. At the end of November 1939, Stalin made a huge mistake. This is according to Suvorov, right? He launched a war against Finland. The victory in Finland was the second warning to Hitler that Stalin was approaching the Swedish sources of ore. The Red Army, acting on Stalin's orders, got through the Finnish fortifications and halted its advance. Finland, without the fortifications, was defenseless. At any moment, Stalin could have given another order and renewed the advance of the Red Army. From Finnish territory, it could have bombed Swedish ore mines and railroads unhindered. No one could have impeded this. The seizure of the Åland Islands alone would have been enough to close off the mouth of the Gulf of Bothnia, which would have meant an end to World War II with a Soviet victory. And that was not all. In the part of Europe that was occupied by Hitler, there are no forests. The forests are in Finland and Sweden. Any possible cessation of the shipment of lumber across the Baltic Sea carried with it a multitude of consequences, and all were negative. And in fact, in Roman times, Germany was heavily forested, but I guess they deforested all of Germany to make farms, right? The wood was needed for building and restoring railroad ties and for mining coal, which was needed for forging steel. No wood meant no transport along the railroads. During peacetime in Germany, there was already a yearly timber shortage of about 6 million tons. Instead of wood pulp, they had to use potato foliage. The Fuhrer himself attests to that. But that was just during peacetime when no one hindered the transport of timber across the Baltic Sea. I think they were using the potato foliage for toilet paper and cheap writing paper and newspaper and things like that instead of wood pulp. As soon as Stalin's submarine struck German timber carriers, Germany would have wound up without wood at all. Potato stocks would not have sufficed to make up the shortage because they cannot replace good wood in all of its uses. It is possible to make poor quality paper out of them, but impossible to make railroad ties, impossible to timber coal mines. On top of everything else, Germany had no nickel. It was impossible to fight without nickel, but the nickel supplies were in Finland. At the beginning of 1940, during the course of the war against Finland, the Red Army had seized control of the nickel mines in Petsamo. And then in the spring of 1940, according to the peace treaty, returned them. But now nickel was obtained according to joint Soviet-Finnish shareholding companies with the participation of Soviet engineers and workers. The Soviet government insisted that the director of the entire operation be a Soviet man. Nickel from Petsamo went to both Germany and the Soviet Union. Germany was receiving 70,000 tons from this area, or 70% of Germany's annual demand of the strategic mineral. However, the nickel supply could be stopped at any moment. The Soviet 104th Rifle Division, under Major General Morozov, stood right outside the nickel mines. German strategists did not fear a new Soviet invasion of Finland in vain. On November 25, 1940, the People's Commissar of Defense of the USSR, Marshal of the Soviet Union, S.K. Timoshenko, and the Chief of General Staff of the Red Army, General K.A. Meretskov, signed a directive to the staff of the Leningrad Military District. Only one copy of the document was produced, and it was labeled top secret and especially important. Let's remember the date. November 25th, 1940. We will return to it later on. The document begins by saying, in the conditions of war only against Finland, the USSR establishes, for convenience of control and material supply, two fronts, the northern front for action on the shoreline of the Barents Sea and in the direction of Rovaniemi, Kemi, and Oulu, the northwestern front for actions directed towards Kuopio, Mikkeli, and Helsinki. The leadership of the Northwestern Front falls on the shoulders of the command and staff of the Leningrad Military District. It is ordered to start the development of plans for operations opening up the Northwestern Front. The main objectives of the Northwestern Front are set: destruction of Finland's armed forces, gaining control of her territories within the boundaries, and gaining access to the Gulf of Bosnia by the 45th day of the operation. On the right, the Northern Front, its staff in Kandalaksha, on the 40th day of mobilization moves to assault, and on the 30th day of operation gains control of the regions of Kemi and Oulu. The Red Flag Baltic Fleet, subordinate in all operations to the Military Council of the Northwestern Front, is issued the following tasks: working jointly with the Air Force, destroy the active navy of Finland and Sweden in case of involvement by the latter. Assist the ground forces acting on the Finland Gulf shore and from Hanko Peninsula by supplying their flanks and destroying the coastal defenses of the Finns. Provide the transfer of two rifle divisions during the first few days of the war from the northern shore of the Estonian SSR to the Hanko Peninsula, as well as transporting and launching an amphibious assault on the Åland Islands through cruiser operations of submarines and air forces, interrupt Finnish-Swedish naval communications in the event of the latter's interference against the USSR in the Gulf of Bosnia and the Baltic Sea. So it's clear that the Soviets did have designs on the region. This plan of action... I'm sorry, John.
Just add to that. After the Russo-Finnish War ended, the Soviets forced the Finns to lease them the port of Hanko at the very edge of the Gulf of Finland. and they used that as a naval base until the Finns retook it when they went to war with the Soviet Union again.
Now we had discussed before, and I know you wanted to mention at this time the British designs on Norway, which would cut Germany off from those resources from the other end, right?
Oh yeah, they. I mentioned before that Hitler was of two minds when he decided to invade Norway. He was very concerned about the iron ore shipments, and that's what made the decision for him. Probably because of the Soviet naval presence on his rear, as well as the British designs on Norway as well. And, you know, in their operation to invade Norway, they lost their furthest expedition to Narvik, which is quite far up. They lost all 10 destroyers in that operation and cut off the German forces that landed there. And they were cut off for several months until June of 1940. But eventually they accomplished their operation.
But so basically, Germany invaded Norway to keep Britain from getting it.
Right, preventing the British from actually threatening Sweden, also, and prevent them from getting those iron ore deposits to stop them from being shipped to Germany. It was absolutely necessary that they had it, according to what you just told us.
And without the iron, Germany had nothing to wage war with, right?
The German invasion of Norway actually happened they narrowly preempted the British invasion, which was scheduled for, I think, a few days later. And at one point, the Germans were even interrupting the British as they were moving in to mine Norwegian harbors. And what right do the British have to mine a neutral nation's harbors?
Well, what right did the British have from separating Iceland from Norway? Norway was a loser in this war
Iceland was separated from Denmark, you mean, Denmark.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, British treachery was very clear.
And then, of course, the
against supposedly occupied nations, right?
The U.S. military relieved the British garrison in Iceland, and that's direct intervention in a war. Basically, the U.S. invaded Denmark.
Yes.
By landing in Iceland, since Iceland was a territory of Denmark.
And liberated one of its colonies from it, right? I mean, Iceland belonged to them. We had no right to do that.
Absolutely.
And Denmark was an occupied nation. I mean, at least the Western media and Western academics considered Denmark an occupied nation. It wasn't a willful ally of Germany.
Well, if
it didn't want to be occupied.
If the nation's occupied, they would probably set up a government in exile in a Western
territory,
such as Iceland. But the U.S. made sure that couldn't happen by taking over Iceland.
Exactly. And they should have set up a government of exile in London or in New York or anywhere. And anywhere where, yeah, you know, whenever it's convenient for the United States or Britain to set up a government in exile, that they'd have no problem taking some emigres and basically appointing them into the government positions
some third generation immigrant who's never been in that home country, and all of a sudden he becomes the prime minister in exile.
Well, there's an entire pattern of them doing, of American treachery in doing that, and British treachery in doing that. But it wasn't done for Denmark. We just separated Denmark and other countries from their resources.
Look, I don't want the chat to guide this, but I'm getting from Troublemaker in here a lie or something that's not true. He's saying that the Germans went through Sweden to invade Norway, and I know that's not true because I know the military history of the operation. They used mainly paratroops and invasion forces from sea. And if he doesn't know that, then he better read his U.S. military history.
He's now trying to claim that Quisling was a Swede who let the Germans go through Sweden to get to Norway. That's the height of stupidity. Quisling was a Norwegian politician who tried to work with the Germans in Norway.
He was actually a good guy, right? Quisling.
He was basically a fascist in Norway.
Yeah, that's true.
He should be remembered as a hero.
And the Swedes would not allow the Germans to transit through Sweden. I believe ultimately at one point, though, they did allow some transiting of supplies through northern Sweden to get to Finland to help the Finns during the Winter War with the Soviets, but they did not allow any German soldiers to go through Sweden for the invasion of Norway.
I don't see how it's necessary for German soldiers to go through Sweden to invade Norway.
He also can't spell Quisling's name, and he's calling his first name A. His first name did not start with an A. His first name was Vidkun. Vidkun Quisling.
Yes, it was.
And I want to point out, too, that one thing the Soviets got when they attacked Finland in 1940, they got the region of Karelia, which is a very strategically important region of Finland, since if you take Karelia, you now have a straight shot to the capital of Finland, basically, since all of their major border defenses were in that Karelian region. And they had a choke point right around Lake Ladoga, or Ladoga, I probably butchered that word, near St. Petersburg, and the Soviets would have been funneled through there. And that's why the war, I think, dragged on as long as it did. They had to basically force their way through that choke point, and they just threw bodies upon bodies, thousands upon thousands of men into that area, and eventually they wore the Finns down. But they ended up getting the most strategic, important region, I think, of southern Finland, Karelia. And it came with about 10 to 15% of Finland's population, and it was one of the most industrial-rich regions in Finland as well. So they really reduced Finland's industrial capacity by taking that region.
Yeah, well, there's about a page and a half left here, unless you guys have something else.
Well, it seems that the liar left immediately after we challenged his lies and muted him. So there's true history and there's his lies, and true history is what we're showing right now.
Well, Troublemaker, you shouldn't allow him to steal time from the program, right? He's a time thief, and he is a liar, and he's a purveyor of Jewish propaganda concerning basically all things historical.
And everything he says, we can show that it is demonstrably false, and we've done that.
Okay, back to Suvorov. This plan of action was given a name, that this plan of action that the Russian war plans against Finland, right, was given the name S-320. The plan was to be put into action at the moment of receipt of the coded telegram with the signature of the chief, I think that is a typo, of the general staff, and the following contents: commence execution of plan S-320. In this plan, there was no mention of the fact that the Soviet Union would fight for the guarantee of safety to the city of Lenin, that is Leningrad. And there were no hints that military actions must be initiated only in response to enemy aggression. The usual words, quote, if the enemy wages war upon us, unquote, were absent. Here it was much simpler. At any moment, the Leningrad staff would receive a telegram from Moscow, and Soviet armies would advance to the Gulf of Bothnia, to the Swedish border, to the Åland Islands. The trusted comrades, at the right moment, would set up a new provocation of the Finnish war machine on our frontier, and those whose job it was to do so would explain to the workers of the world the meaning of the peace-loving global politics of the USSR and the necessity of our counterblows to the Finnish aggressors. And Suvorov's being very tongue-in-cheek there, right? The plan, S-320, could have been a standalone one, but it could also have been part of a much broader scheme. The plan, S-320, allowed the armies of the Leningrad and Archangelsk districts, together with the Baltic fleet, to deliver blows to Finland before the Red Army hit Germany, simultaneously or slightly later. But in any case, the blow to Finland was also a blow to Germany. In the event of putting plan S-320 into action, Soviet troops were to seize the nickel mines in Petsamo and the Åland Islands and make their way to the city of Kemi. It was not a coincidence that in 1940 on the Baltic Sea, the 1st Marine Infantry Brigade was formed under the leadership of the Soviet saboteur Colonel Parafilo. It remained only to send to the Leningrad headquarters the coded message, bring plan into execution. There is no need to search for a plan for war against Germany. If plan S-320 had been realized, it meant a deadly blow not only to Finland, but to Germany as well. In the summer of 1940, Stalin committed another error. He brought Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania into the Soviet Union, organized on their territory the Baltic Special Military District, and concentrated all the forces of that region on the border of eastern Prussia. This was completely unnecessary and even harmful for defense. Some say that Stalin moved his border to the west and thus strengthened the safety of the USSR. But in fact, the situation was exactly the opposite. Before the occupation of the Baltic states, the Red Army had a divisive barrier in this region. Consequently, in the event of aggression, Hitler's armies had to crush the armed forces of three independent states before meeting the Red Army, even if he had to spend only a few days in order to crush the armies of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. A surprise attack on Soviet air bases in this direction would have been out of the question. The Red Army would have had the chance to put its forces on high alert and take its positions. After the destruction of the three states' armies, Hitler's forces would have approached Lake Chudzko, which is impossible to cross. If they had tried to go around the lake, Hitler's armies would have come straight into Soviet fortified areas. So Suvorov believes that the taking of the Baltic states as SSRs caused the Soviets to advance their armies into those Baltic states and abandon well-fortified areas to their rear.
Well, remember what Molotov said. Finland was getting ready to destroy the Soviet Union and it had to be stopped.
Oh, right. And that's just like saying that Haiti is about to attack the United States, right?
No, Bill, that was a very good point by Suvorov. Yeah, invading the Baltic states meant they lacked that buffer area to in case of a German surprise attack, which really wasn't going to come anyway.
Well, right. They lacked the buffer area. They lacked any chance of a warning of a German surprise attack, and they abandoned well-fortified areas that were now in their rear that they wouldn't have time to flee to later. But everything unfolded according to a different scenario. The Red Army came out of its fortified areas to the front lines in Lithuania, right up to the German border, and transferred there its air bases, staff headquarters, communication centers, and strategic supply resources. For the people of the three Baltic states, Stalin's army became the aggressor and occupant, and Germany, if it decided to attack the USSR, would have become the liberator. So Stalin also made a political blunder there, according to Suvorov's assessment, which is probably a good one. Not that it mattered in the long run. On June 22, 1941, the Red Army suffered a surprise attack from the German armies along the entire stretch of the border, including the Baltic states. The command centers were disrupted, and Soviet aviation suffered significant losses on border air bases. Moreover, a widespread popular uprising in the Baltic states flared up against the Red Army. The Soviet liberators were shot at from every rooftop. The Red Army was left in the Baltic region without any fortified regions, and behind their backs on Russian territory remained empty fortified areas without any troops. German troops led by General Field Marshal von Manstein seized them immediately. Skeptics disagree. If Stalin had not occupied the Baltic states, Hitler could have seized them without war by simply moving his troops there, as he did in Czechoslovakia. To this theory, there is rebuttal. It should have been explained to Hitler clearly that if German troops attempted to enter the Baltic states, the Soviet Union, without warning, would begin sinking German transports of ore and wood in the Baltic Sea, setting up mines in the entryways of German ports, and bombing Berlin. The Soviet Union would form international brigades and launch them into the Baltic states territory with millions of Soviet volunteers. And when Hitler's forces grew weak, and Suvorov is being conjectural here, right? And when Hitler's forces grew weak in war with the USSR, Britain and France would use the opportunity and strangle Germany according to their best interests, eliminating it as a dangerous adversary and once again imposing retributions. Now this is a good point Suvorov makes concerning Stalin, because he explains how they did the same, that very thing to the Japanese, right? Such a declaration would have been correctly understood around the world. In such an event, the people of the Baltic states would not have been enemies of the Soviets, but their allies. In such an event, the Forrest brothers, who were the Baltic states' partisans, would have been shooting the backs of German soldiers and not the Soviets. In such an event, international brigades would have been fighting on the side of the Baltic states. There were always enough volunteers to be found around the world. In August 1939, the Soviet Union's position was announced loud and clear. Mongolian territory will be defended from Japanese aggression as if it was our own, and that was done. This position was correctly understood in the entire world, including Japan. As a result of this decisiveness and strictness, Japanese aggression against the Soviet Union was averted. Why did the Soviet Union in 1939 not take the same position regarding the Baltic states? The occupation of those states by the Red Army made sense only if there were plans for an aggressive war against Germany. In other words, their occupation of the Baltic states proves that they were planning an aggressive war against the rest of Europe.
And that's clearly a stepping off point to attack East Prussia.
Exactly.
Yeah, really excellent.
The Red Army came right up to the German border and transferred its air bases to the very front edge of that border. From the bases in Lithuania, it could support the advance of Soviet troops right up to Berlin. Additionally, the Soviet Navy received bases in Tallinn, Riga, and Lipaja. The primary forces of the Navy and reserves were immediately transferred there. From Lipaja to the routes, I'm probably destroying that pronunciation. From the routes taken by caravans carrying ore, nickel, and wood to Germany, there was a very small distance. A strike from this area could be sudden and crippling. For Hitler, this would have been the curtain call. Hitler understood that at any moment, the Soviet fleet could cut the only tie binding the faraway Swedish ports with the metal forging bases in Germany. And that's it for that chapter of Suvorov's The Chief Culprit. I have some supportive material from David Irving from Hitler's War. And I don't know if you've read that, John, or if you've read that, Sword Brethren, but I haven't personally read a whole lot of Hitler's work. But today I perused large parts of Hitler's War, which I have some excerpts from here. And it seems to me, and I didn't have time to read the whole book, right? But it seems to me that Irving displayed a very typical Anglo bias against Hitler. At least 10 times in the book, he portrays Hitler's top aides as his henchmen and calls the German leadership an authoritarian military dictatorship, even in contexts earlier than 1940. And in his introduction, he also accepts the historicity of the Holocaust and blames it not on Hitler, but on, quote, a large number of Germans, many of them alive today. And so I'm really disappointed in David Irving.
Bill, David Irving wrote that book a couple of decades ago, at least. So he made his understanding of the nature of the Holocaust before the 90s was rather limited. He was continuing researching it. He just probably, like most people, he didn't want to go there because he would be stepping on people's toes.
Well, this is from the version last updated Friday. I understand that he wrote the book a couple of decades ago, but this version is marked last updated Friday, April 13th, 2001. So maybe he didn't update. I mean, I know it's 970-something pages, but maybe he just didn't update enough of it, right?
Right.
There is also another long statement in Irving's introduction, and I find it confusingly wrong. I mean, that's my personal opinion, right? I'm going to quote it. Being a modern English historian, there was a certain morbid fascination for me in inquiring how far Adolf Hitler really was bent on the destruction of Britain and her empire, a major raison d'etre for our ruinous fight, which in 1940 imperceptibly replaced the more implausible mentions reason proffered in August 1939, the rescue of Poland from outside oppression. And my response to that would be that, yeah, even though earlier in the introduction, Irving mentions Hitler's unwillingness to humiliate Britain when she lay prostrate in 1940, in other words, by wiping out those men at Dunkirk, right? And very often quotes from or refers to Mein Kampf. Irving seemed to have had an intimate familiarity with Mein Kampf. It is both clear to me in action and in word that Hitler never wanted to destroy Britain. And for these reasons, I'm viewing David Irving as just another court historian, even though he certainly later had an epiphany concerning the fallacy of the claims concerning gas chambers.
Well, that sounds appropriate to me, too.
I was really disappointed reading David Irving today, and it's my first foray into his writing. I'd like to read a couple of pages from the chapter, The Barbarossa Directive. And another thing I observed was that when Irving wrote this, he had no clue. It seems to me that he had no clue of Hitler's necessity to attack Russia in order to prevent being attacked.
So he bought the mainstream lie that Hitler just decided to attack the Soviet Union and destroy them and take all their resources.
Well, at this point in my reading of Irving, I believe I could reach that conclusion, yes. This is a quote from pages 349 to 350 of Hitler's War. Molotov's negative reply to Hitler's proposals at the end of November 1940 dispelled whatever hesitations he still had about attacking Russia, meaning Hitler. Visiting the 6th Fedor von Bock again briefly on December 3rd, the Field Marshal's 60th birthday, Hitler warned that the Eastern problem was now coming to a head. This in turn made a joint Anglo-Russian enterprise more likely. If the Russians are eliminated, he amplified, Britain will have no hope whatever of defeating us on the continent. To Brockitsch, 2 days later, Hitler announced the hegemony of Europe will be decided in the fight with Russia. Thus, his strategic timetable took shape. He would execute the attack on Greece, codenamed Merida, after one of Yodel's daughters, early in March 1941. Of course, if the Greeks saw... I'm sorry, I lost my place. Darn keyboard buttons. Of course, if the Greeks saw the light that showed their British guests the door, he would call off Merida altogether. He had no interest in whatever in occupying Greece. Then he would attack Russia during May. In 3 weeks, we shall be in Leningrad, Schmunt heard him say. Virtually nothing was known about the Red Army. A complete search of archives in France, Russia's own ally, had yielded nothing. Hitler was confident that the German Mark III tank with its 50-millimeter gun, provided clear superiority over the obsolete Red Army equipment. They would have 1,500 of these tanks by spring. The Russian himself is inferior, quoting Hitler. His army has no leaders, he assured his generals. Once the Russian army has been beaten, the disaster will take its inevitable course. I don't know if that's a fair assessment on Irving's part, that the Germans knew nothing about the Red Army, and they were searching archives in France to find out about the Red Army. I don't know if that's – it doesn't sound like a very fair assessment for me from what I've read elsewhere.
Hmm.
And I don't know if you guys are ready to comment on that, but I think that Irving is making Hitler sound like and his staff sound like bumbling fools concerning the Russians.
Well, I certainly would say that they did not – underestimate the Soviet Union. They knew it was going to be tough going.
Well,
I mean, look at the force concentration that they brought in. They had three entire army groups, and initially, if we go by the forces the Soviets had on the border, immediately on the border, the Germans outnumbered the Soviets in terms of manpower on the open offensive.
I'm sorry, later in the war, and now I remember reading this. I'm not sure if it's true or not because I can't cite the source. But when Hitler had put Guderian in charge of the Panzer troops, he commented to him, and now, again, I can't cite my source, that if he knew about Soviet tank production, he would never have invaded. But, again, you know, that could just be a faulty source.
It seems to me Suvorov gives Hitler more credit than Irving does, that's for certain. At 3 p.m. on December 5th, Hitler's military advisors came to the chancellery to mull over each phase of these coming operations. Now, for the first time, the two varying concepts of the Russian military campaign were brought into informal synthesis. Halder's general staff proposal was distinguished by a particularly powerful main drive toward Moscow. Lossberg's OKW study, Fritz, attached more weight to the northernmost army group and the occupation of the Baltic coast. In his reply to Halder, the Führer now drew heavily on Lossberg's arguments. And this actually I think is being very fair to Hitler, because Hitler is often portrayed as a tyrant who hands down plans for world conquest and doesn't give his generals any credit at all.
And they also portray him as incompetent, of course.
Well, right. But here, Irving is portraying Hitler as leaning heavily on his generals and trying to assess the best of two different plans for war against Russia.
Well, up until they started losing on the Eastern Front, Hitler did put a lot of his trust in his generals. I mean, the first Soviet counteroffensive in the winter, Hitler started to take over, and he sacked about 40 generals. That includes all three field marshals in command of the each army group, as well as Guderian and others.
Well, maybe later in the season we'll talk about some of Hitler's generals and some of the problems with personalities and conflicts and things like that. There are a couple of articles available. I don't have a whole wealth of material on the topic, but there are a couple of articles available that explain some of the problems with Hitler's generals. Both Halder's plan and Lossberg's plan assumed that the Russians must of necessity defend the western areas of the Soviet Union and the Ukraine, and both stated that the Russians must be prevented from staging an orderly retreat as in 1812. That would be against Napoleon. The army and OKW were also agreed that they must occupy as much Soviet territory as necessary. This would prevent the Russian Air Force from reaching Reich territory. Halder proposed that the offensive end along a line from the Volga River to Archangelsk, which is on the White Sea, right?
Right.
Where Hitler took exception was to Halder's insistence that nothing detract from the main assault on Moscow. Hitler wanted the Russian forces in the Baltic countries to be encircled first. A similar huge encirclement action by Army Group South of the Pripyat Marshes would liquidate the Russian armies in the Ukraine. Only after that should it be decided whether to advance on Moscow or to bypass the Soviet capital in the rear. Moscow is not all that important, Hitler explained. When the first draft directive for the Russian campaign was brought to Hitler by Jodl, it still conformed with Halder's recommendation of a main thrust toward Moscow, in conformity with the plan submitted to me, quote-unquote. Hitler, however, ordered the document redrafted in the form he had emphasized. The principal task of the two army groups operating north of the Pripyat Marshes was to drive the Russians out of the Baltic countries. His motives were clear. The Baltic was the Navy's training ground and the route which German ore supplies from Scandinavia had to take. Besides, when the Russians had been destroyed in the Baltic countries, great forces would be released for other operations. The Russian campaign must be settled before 1941 was over, for from 1942 onward, the United States would be capable of intervening. Toward the United States, Hitler was to display unwanted patience despite extreme provocations for one long year. American nationals were fighting in the ranks of the Royal Air Force, and the United States warships were shadowing Axis merchant ships plying their trade in transatlantic waters. The Admiralty in Berlin knew from its radio reconnaissance that the Americans were passing on to the British the information about these blockade runners. And we've discussed this in prior programs here, right? The last
Absolutely.
Few weeks.
And they were even attacking German U-boats in some instances.
Yes. In vain, Admiral Rader protested to Hitler about this glaring proof of the United States' non-neutrality. he asked whether to ignore this was compatible with the honor of the German Reich. Nothing would alter Hitler's determined refusal to take up the American gauntlet, nor would he be sidetracked into invading England. In a secret speech to the Gauleiters on December 11th, he declared the war as good as won and assured them that invasion is not planned for the time being. Air supremacy necessary first, concluded Dr. Goebbels afterwards in his diary, and added his own one-word comment on Hitler's psychosis, hydrophobia. Hitler had an aversion to carrying any military operation across the seas. He had also shrewdly refrained from revealing to Dr. Goebbels his plan to attack the Soviet Union. He's frightened of the water, Goebbels recorded after again speaking to Hitler on the 22nd about invading England, to which he added, he says he would undertake it only if he was in the direst straits. Unbeknownst to the propaganda minister, Hitler's eyes were fastened upon Russia. On December 18th, Jodl brought him the final version of the campaign directive, retyped on a large Führer typewriter. It had been renamed Barbarossa, partly the handiwork of Jodl, whose spoken German was very clear and simple, and partly the product of Hitler's pen. The 11-page document instructed the Wehrmacht to be prepared to overthrow Soviet Russia in a rapid campaign even before the war with Britain is over. All preparations were to be completed by mid-May 1941. I'll skip ahead to page 359. This might be one consequence of the German capture of the Ukraine, Moscow and Leningrad, replied Hitler. Otherwise, the Wehrmacht must advance towards Ekaterinburg. Anyway, he concluded, I'm glad that we carried on with arms manufacture so that we are now strong enough to be a match for anybody. We have more than enough material, and we have already have begun thinking about converting parts of our industry, I guess, away from war arms manufacture. Our Wehrmacht manpower position is better than when war broke out. Our economy is absolutely firm. The Führer rejected out of hand any idea of yielding, not that Bach had hinted at it. I am going to fight, he said, and I am convinced that our attack will flatten them like a hailstorm, meaning the attack on Russia. 2 days later, Field Marshal von Brauchitsch brought the Chief of General Staff, Franz Halder, to the Chancellery, I'm tripping over my tongue tonight, I'm sorry, to outline the Army's operational directive on Barbarossa. Although Army intelligence believed the Russians might have as many as 10,000 tanks compared with their own 3,500, the Russian armored vehicles were a motley collection of obsolete design. Even so, surprises cannot be ruled out altogether, warned Halder. As for the Russian soldier, Halder believed the Germans were superior in experience, training, equipment, organization, command, national character, and ideology. Hitler naturally agreed. As for Soviet armament, he was something of an expert on arms production, he said. And from memory, he recited a 10-minute statistical lecture on Russian tank production since 1928. Now that paragraph, to me, disputes Irving's own comments on the German knowledge of the Red Army made earlier in the chapter. Hitler approved the Army's directive, but once again he emphasized the capture of the Baltic coast and of Leningrad. The latter was particularly important if the Russians were falling back elsewhere, as this northern stronghold would provide the best possible supply base for the second phase of the campaign. Hitler knew that Halder had just had a first round of talks with his Finnish counterpart, General Erich Heinrichs, in Berlin. He was convinced the Finns would make ideal allies, although Finland's political strategy would be problematical, as she wished to avoid a complete rupture with the United States and Britain. And he said to his staff, they were a plucky people, and at least I will have a good flank defense there, quite apart from which it is always good to have comrades in arms who are thirsting for revenge. And it seems to me that that's the end of my comments from David Irving's chapter on Barbarossa, and it seems to me that Irving was really not aware of the necessity for Hitler to act against the Soviets at all, and which would have been out of a desire to defend Europe against the planned onslaught of the Mongol hordes, which was being planned by Stalin. And the he draws a very cavalier picture of Adolf Hitler. And I don't really understand it. And I don't know, maybe that's just because
Irving's opinion is Hitler took the matter very lightly.
Well, right. He seems to have portrayed Hitler as being one of absolute cavalier confidence or uncautious, yet, you know, nonchalance.
I would say he's trying to paint him in the typical British propaganda style as a megalomaniac.
Well, right. That's my exact point. I just can't phrase it correctly. Nah, Hitler thinks he's going to beat Russia in 3 weeks and it's all going to be over and then he's going to do in Britain, right? And it all seems to me to be right out of the British propaganda that we've always heard concerning Hitler. I was very disappointed with this book from Irving as I read these chapters in this afternoon.
Yeah, it's like you mentioned it before, Bill. An irrational view of history doesn't make sense. That's what it is. They're trying to paint him as irrational. How can a man reach his position being irrational?
Well, absolutely. And it seems to me that Irving, I don't know, maybe he's come a long way in the last 20 years, but I was disappointed in this book.
Hitler knew it was going to be a decisive encounter. It wasn't anything to take lightly.
Well, absolutely. It was very important to him, and it was very important to succeed because he knew that the fate of Europe rested on the success of his campaign against the communists, against the Bolshevik regime in Russia. I think Hitler knew all of the historical consequences that were at stake. I think he probably believed that there would be no more Germany if they lost to the Bolsheviks.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And pretty much today there is no more world. There are no more nations. We just have a UN that runs things.
Well, right. We've all lost. We've all lost World War II. And in fact, the only people that won World War II is the Jews.
And the greatest generation that now gets all the benefits for fighting for their masters.
And whenever anybody's asked who won World War II, the answer should be the Jews. Well, that's all I have for tonight. I mean, we could probably continue this discussion on other fronts in coming weeks, and we'll probably talk about that during the week, right?
All right, so we'll pick up next weekend then?
Absolutely.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you, gentlemen. Yahweh bless.
Great, Yahweh. Thank you.